This podcast is intended for investment professionals.
Environmental, social and governance integration, ESG, responsible investing and sustainable investing are just a few of the myriad ways to describe a mode of asset allocation which aims to look at more than just the financial bottom line when assessing performance. According to IPE, over 26% of global assets now sit within this variously titled space, and as growing numbers seek to adopt the principles of responsible investing into their investment portfolios, the world of factor-based investing is far from immune. 55% of European asset owners surveyed by FTSE Russell in 2018 said they were looking to integrate ESG considerations within their factor portfolios, but as yet, no clear picture of how best to do this has emerged. I'm Eliza Grimmond, investment writer here at LGIM, and today I am joined by Dave Barron, head of index equity and smart beta, and Adam Willis, head of index and multi-asset distribution, to find out if responsible investing is a factor friend or a factor foe. Dave, welcome to the studio.
Thanks.
To kick us off, can you just explain in a sentence for me what exactly we mean by factor-based investing and its partner, multi-factor-based investing?
Sure. One sentence. Okay. It really just means allocating to a certain group of stocks that exhibit a common characteristic that's proven to deliver superior risk-adjusted returns over long periods of time. So these are your value stocks, your momentum stocks, quality, et cetera. And the multi-factor concept is combining those in a single portfolio to potentially reduce the longevity and severity of drawdowns of any one of the single factors.
And now, Adam, over to you. Why is there growing interest in integrating ESG considerations into FBI portfolios now?
Sure. Before we jump into that, maybe just to start on factor-based portfolios and where we see the growth there. So as we've heard at the top, investors have been looking for tried and tested styles of investing that deliver better risk-adjusted returns than a market cap strategy. And factors certainly meet that definition in the way that, Dave has described it. We've seen conservative estimates that there'll be $1.6 trillion of factor-based investing assets by 2020. So when you talk about the 55% of investors looking to add ESG into their factor portfolios, we're talking about a big number of assets. And that's an important thing to establish. But looking to your question about why would you want to integrate ESG into your factor portfolios, well, I guess the first point is this is a big pool of assets. FBI is a genuine tool now for long-term investors to use in their portfolio. So it's not going anywhere. So the stage is really set to integrate ESG practices into those portfolios. Now, there are a bunch of reasons that that might happen. The first one, I guess, is really around, particularly for UK, DB and DC investors, is around the regulations coming from the DWP, which is a requirement on those investors to add to their statement of investment principles.
That's the Department of Work and Pensions.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yes, thank you. Less of the abbreviations and acronyms. To update their statement of investment principles to include their policy and practices around stewardship. So that's number one. Increasingly, we are seeing investors also that represent a particular sponsor or an institution that has either a political or other position that requires them to have a statement and outwardly be active on this. So we're starting to see motivation from investors like that. And we're also seeing, as a source of competitive advantage, DC investors wanting to include these types of investment options for a particular cohort of investors that these styles might appeal to. And in particular, I'm thinking about millennials who, are increasingly wanting to invest in this way. And so if they're the reasons that investors might come to us in the first place, we see two sort of approaches from an investment point of view. We see an emerging cohort of investors that are looking to ESG principles as a way to generate better investment outcomes, and certainly long-term better investment outcomes. And then we see another group that are coming at it from more of a risk perspective, so looking to exclude certain industries, certain sectors, or certain stocks to avoid what they see as the potential risks associated with investing in those stocks over the long term.
I see. So we've got this kind of tripartite approach firstly, trustees looking to integrate that DWP regulation, secondly, DC schemes looking to improve member engagement, and also perhaps sponsors who have associated risks. Just swivelling back to Dave, could you describe the current landscape in terms of the FBI providers out there at the moment? I mean, as Adam mentioned, there's been a huge increase in the number of assets in FBI portfolios in the last year. I mean, I read a figure yesterday which said that just a year ago, the estimate for assets in FBI was $1 trillion, and now it seems to have jumped to 1.9, which is astronomical.
Yeah. Continued interest in what is continued interest in AUM bring? Well, it brings a lot of people trying to provide product. So if you look at the landscape, it's extremely crowded. We estimate, and this is just index space in general, so not necessarily specific to factors, but over 3.2 million indices in publication, which is 70-fold the number of equity securities. You know, that's a lot of product choice. And now we're adding a new dynamic, a new metric to kind of integrate into portfolios, and that's ESG. So you think about the number of products, and it'll continue to proliferate. Now, the good news is that's choice, right? Clients can find a product that theoretically matches their objectives. The bad news is sometimes products might say one thing on the tin and perform quite differently. So we really stress the importance of identifying, you know, what your investment objectives are, and then matching that with a product. And that's something that we definitely work with our clients on quite closely.
And just to pick up on that point about data disparities, the current picture seems to be one of considerable confusion. There seems to be an abundance of ESG criteria and measurements, which has created quite significant disparities between providers, so index providers, ESG scores. Could you just give me a little bit more detail on that, please?
Yeah, so you know, there's been a long history of integrating the concepts of ESG into portfolio and security analysis. However, you know, formalizing that into a score is relatively in its infancy, and a lot of providers are grappling with the typical problems that you would face when you try and, you know, use a whole host of indicators and narrow that down into a final score that basically tells you if a company is good or bad. And so, if you think about just from a pure numbers games perspective, you know, you see a lot of providers of ESG scores focus on, you know, 300 plus raw metrics that they're going to use to eventually boil down into, you know, final ESG score. Some of them are narrowing that down to focus on key indicators, things that are relevant for that company or a company within an industry. Some have other ways of boiling that down. So let's say you get to a point where you have 30 or so key metrics that are defining a company, but then you have to think, okay, now I've got 30 metrics. Now I have to determine, you know, how to turn a raw score like a percentage of women on the board or you know, amount of emissions intensity into that company's value. And there's all sorts of different ways that providers can subjectively decide how to turn raw metric detail into a final score. And so it's no surprise that ultimately when you look at different provider ESG scores at the very, very end, they're not very correlated. In fact, you know, we estimate that among some of the top providers of ESG scores, correlations are as low as 30 to 40% between ESG scores. Big point here is that sounds like a bad thing, and it's something to definitely look into, but the rationale behind the differences and the different choices is something that clients can actually investigate and adhere to or match their objectives or their views to the way a different provider creates those ESG scores. And so, you know, I guess the point of the logical conclusion there is find the ESG data provider that aligns with your investment objectives or your general objectives and use that as your preferred input to a product.
Just delving a little bit more deeply into that subject, you've talked a lot in the past about the two, or is it actually three, kinds of ESG integration that factor managers have concentrated on so far in the journey. Could you give me a little bit more color on what these approaches are and maybe explain if any of these approaches are easier or harder to integrate into an FBI portfolio?
Yeah, so I think, you know, when you're thinking about it in the ESG score context, you know, everyone wants to, you know, as Adam kind of highlighted, the objectives may be, you know, one of you know, mitigating downside risks. So think about, you know, climate change risk and identifying companies with large exposure to oil sands, for example. You know, you could theoretically penalize a company who's got a lot of potential stranded asset risk, and that can be integrated into your score. So that's kind of one of the ways that a raw metric can be turned into something that can impact an overall ESG score and therefore the ultimate investment into that type of company in your portfolio. There's also more of the, I'd call it not necessarily ethical, but just more long-term thematic, socially responsible ways to turn raw metrics into scores. And these are things that, typically are somewhat linked to better company performance, but are less tangible, not as tangible as maybe a stranded asset risk. So things within governance and having appropriate policies and supports for your employees and things like that. So these are less tangible metrics that are still quantified in that realm of 300 plus indicators that are a little bit more difficult to assign an actual value to. And so that's kind of the differing ways these scores can be created and can end up in different investment products.
Just jumping in there, it's important to say that these techniques that you've just described, they're not mutually exclusive. So you can see both exclusion type restrictions in an ESG portfolio combined with upweighting based on various ESG metrics as well. Is that correct? Or?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Different ways to do it. And again, that ultimately, depends on your objective as an investor, what you want that final portfolio to do. Is it relative to a starting point? Is it in isolation? Are you looking for max impact on various metrics? Are you focused on one of the subcomponents of the ES and G? So it really does depend. But yes, fair to say.
And just building on that question from Adam, how can the effects of these approaches be accurately measured over the long term?
This is the million-dollar question, or billion-dollar question, I guess.
Or trillion-dollar question.
Maybe trillion.
These days.
Yeah, it's getting bigger and bigger. One of the high hopes is that there is some consistency in the way that people interpret raw data into a score. I think and this is providers and practitioners, because what you don't want is you don't necessarily want inconsistency driving security prices in opposite directions with respect to ESG scores. So that's a nuanced point, but I think in order to assess the performance, we're going to need to see history and we're going to need to see long periods of time where these types of products have been developed and appropriately attributed. And so this portion of my return is coming from the fact that I held the top 100 ESG companies, or I excluded the bottom 50, or I tilted, or, these are the things that we'll have to play out over time. It will be possible, but time is the key, in order to draw any logical conclusions.
I mean, just to round out what David has had to contribute to that point, I think why this is a challenging process for investors is we're marrying together one star, which is factor-based investing, which has decades of evidence of persistence, is academic consensus that the factors are persistent. Within a certain range, the portfolio outcomes are over the long term relatively predictable, with something that's different, that doesn't have the decades of evidence of persistence. There is an emerging picture of consensus around the materiality of these factors, or risk factors is probably a better way to describe them. And that can be complicated for investors because we're bringing together something that's tried and tested with something that is emerging, and that's can make portfolio outcomes uncertain in the short term.
And where do you think that leaves our clients? Is there any standardization emerging, or are clients exploring a variety of different approaches here?
The nexus of what David was saying about the index providers and the difference that they have in terms of the way that they score portfolios is that there's standardization emerging around which risk factors are important in ESG, but perhaps not standardization on the best way to define and score off the back of that particular risk factor. And I think as this part or this kind of area of investing evolves, we would like to see more leadership and standardization to help guide investors to perhaps the best outcomes that meet their investment beliefs.
That's really interesting. Thank you. Just pivoting on to sort of the second part of this discussion, we're going to talk a little bit more about portfolio integration and how to integrate ESG into your factor-based portfolios. Dave, would you just be able to talk us through the main approaches to ESG integration and FBI that have emerged so far, obviously cognizant that this is an ever-evolving space?
Yeah, sure. So I think, this is making an assumption that you have some knowledge of the standard ways that factors are constructed or factor-based portfolios are constructed. So now we're bringing ESG into it. And where can we bring in ESG? There's really, we've seen three, and it probably is there's different nuances here, but this encompasses most of it. One is just the traditional bottom-up approach. So you've got your factors and your scoring companies based on your traditional factors, and you bring ESG in as a, just another metric in that bottom-up approach. So you end up trying to hold, let's say it's multi-factor in ESG, the company with the best quality score, the best value score, right, the best low volatility score, et cetera, and the best ESG score, which can be subject to isolating a handful of companies or removing a certain number of companies from a universe. You really, in that kind of a bottom-up approach, you theoretically have the most robust exposure to your targeted factors or characteristics, but you end up with a lot of concentration, factor champions and ESG champions. That's one. Two is combining ESG scores with other constraints up at the very end of the process. So basically, that's kind of a top-down, pure top-down approach where you take factor portfolio A and you allocate to ESG portfolio B, and you just kind of adjust your weights according to your asset allocation. So that kind of approach can result in some cancellation effect. So you might have a positive company in your factor portfolio that might be a negative ESG company, and you end up just kind of offsetting. So there's concerns about that, but it comes with a lot of transparency and ease, and you can adjust your asset allocation accordingly. And then the last is just kind of an exclusionary approach where you remove maybe the laggards, and that could be aggregate laggards or laggards within industries. So you basically take your universe before you've applied factors, narrow it down to a subset of stocks, and then apply your factor methodology. And that's kind of a nice, you know, you're going to get positive ESG impact. You still have the strong, potentially strong exposure to all your factors, and it's fairly easy to attribute the difference between an ESG excluded portfolio and one with just pure factor exposure.
So sort of similarly to data provider selection, it's all in the hands of the client, and the client needs to work out, first of all, what their ideal ESG exposure would be, and secondly, how best to implement it.
That's a fair point. I think that's definitely how we'd approach it. You know, depending on constraints like tracking error, like ESG impact that you're looking to achieve. Those are all the key points that you'd want to analyze and then determine what strategy is appropriate for you. And importantly, understand how these types of strategies can vary throughout time. Because, if you set something up in a rules-based methodology, it might look, good on day one, but you need to know what the impact may be over time. And so understanding how the methodology will adapt is an important component.
On methodology, actually, attribution-wise, ESG integration seems to be a bit of a moving target at the moment, as many ESG metrics that we use today simply didn't exist 10 years ago. How is the industry tackling that?
It's one of those ongoing developing debates. It's something that we constantly get asked for. Can you tell me how much of this return is associated with ESG and how much is not? Depending on your portfolio construction choice, it's easier to do than others. You know, in the bottom-up approach, candidly, it's a little bit more difficult to disaggregate the exact final weight of a security. In some of the top-down approaches, it's much more easy to say this, ESG portfolio delivered X, the factor-only portfolio delivered Y, and therefore there's the combination. So it's something that the industry is focused on. But again, it's going to take a lot of time. We need more history, more data to draw, unequivocal conclusions about what may be an appropriate way to integrate.
So it's a developing space then.
It is.
And I suppose this is a problem that's common to factor-based investing generally, but once you add the layer of ESG, it becomes even more prescient. How do you deal with stocks which simply won't stay in a single factor bucket? So, for example, I'm thinking the energy sector with regards to ESG consideration scoring.
Yeah, this is kind of one of my favorite experiments that you can look to. And early ESG and factor research, I think, jumped the correlation versus causation kind of debate. Effectively, a lot of the ESG history is developed post-financial crisis when a lot of this index product was being developed. And everyone who was underweight energy because of potential stranded asset risk saw strong performance when oil prices plummeted. So when oil prices plummet, that's generally bad for energy stocks. So energy stock price comes down, but perhaps the value of those energy stocks haven't necessarily changed. So what ended up happening, and a lot of practitioners concluded very quickly, that value stocks don't play well with strong ESG stocks. And so there's this negative correlation effect. And so if you were to combine value and ESG, there's this big offset or big cancellation. That was probably a little bit too quick of a conclusion to draw, because if you looked at the macro environment during that period of time, value just happened to be in energy. And if you look back historically, value doesn't always sit. It's one of those factors that don't just sit in a single industry bucket. ESG tends to often, you know, sit within different industries or impact different industries more consistently. So if I break up the five main factors, value, size, momentum, they jump around, right? Momentum's been in tech for a little while. So you need to know how ESG relates to tech companies in order to understand how momentum's going to interact with tech. And if momentum now jumps to a new sector, you need to understand the implications of what sector ESG scores or ESG criteria may look like. So it's a very interesting topic, but it's not necessarily consistent throughout time.
But conversely, there do seem to be some factors which seem to correlate quite well with ESG integration. Is that right?
I think one of the things that seems to be a consistent conclusion is quality metrics and governance is fairly closely linked, which has some logical reasons behind that. Quality also tends to be a more stable factor, so the consistency of the companies that score highly or poorly on ESG are pretty consistent with the industries where quality plays. Low volatility is another consistent factor, you know, generally in more defensive sectors, and therefore, you know, the ESG criteria will be more consistent over time with respect to its relationship to low volatility as well.
A question for you, Adam. Do you fear that there could be some factor overcrowding if certain factors become heavily associated with ESG integration?
I do. I think there's certainly evidence in recent times that a style of investing can become its own premium sheerly by the weight of assets that are in that style. And we only need to look at low vol post the crisis. And there's a kind of growing sort of body of research that points to the fact that low vol stocks have been particularly overvalued. And that has been the source of the premium rather than the low vol anomaly itself. So I think that, you know, there's certainly kind of evidence that this could happen. For the proponents of ESG integration, I guess that would be a champagne problem if ESG investing becomes its own premium. But I think we're a fair way away from that.
Okay, now another $1 trillion question for both of you. Is ESG a true factor?
That is a $1 trillion question. This is one that, again, you know, one of the common themes today is the fact that ESG scores are somewhat in their infancy. You know, the concept has been around for a long time, but formalizing that is fairly new, and new relative to the criteria, the hurdle rate that the other factors have gone through. So you think about value, you know, Fama French have explored this in the 70s and again in the 90s with data dating back to 1926, and there's research from Graham and Dodd during that period of time. So the rationale or the hurdle rate or the amount of data necessary to unequivocally say this exists through all regimes and seems to persist is a pretty high hurdle. And given the short history of ESG scores and some of the inconsistencies, it's hard to unequivocally draw that conclusion. I think there's some logical rationales why a well-governed company would be a better performing company. Those are things that you can logically conclude. And you know, long-term themes, if stranded assets are a real risk for certain companies and the market's underappreciating that obviously could potentially, you know, alleviate or reduce downside risk for a portfolio. But I really do. It's going to be one of those things that's going to take some time. We need some more consistency and some more history before we can draw that conclusion, in my opinion.
So, Adam, do you agree that it's a waiting game?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the jury's out in terms of decades of evidence of persistence. The jury's probably out on the academic consensus required as well. I also think that in factor space, we have this kind of, let's think about the rationale for the factor to persist. Is there a structural, behavioral, or risk-based explanation for who is on the other side of the trade and why that factor will persist? Now, in ESG, that's a little bit more complicated, right? It's harder to think about. And then when you do think about that, there's certain crossover with traditional factors. If you take resource efficiency, for example, maybe that's an ESG factor that drives performance, but are they just quality companies that manage their resources well? And I think, you know, as the time series of evidence increases, we may get to a space where we can talk more confidently about ESG factors.
I'm afraid that's all we've got time for, but thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you'd like to find out more, we've linked to Dave's recent article, Responsible Investing, Factor Friend or Foe, in the episode show notes. It's also available on our website. Thanks for listening.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.